all across America and around the world. This is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net. We are recording today from the Legal Help for Veterans studio in Northville, Michigan. Legal Help for Veterans is a veterans disability law firm. You can reach us at 800-693-4800. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Lieutenant Commander Robert Overtuff, retired from the United States Navy. Bob, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, we have you specifically on because you were on the ship, the USS Cole, back in October of 2000 when the bombing occurred, the terrorist attack occurred on that United States Navy guided missile destroyer over in Yemen. So we want to talk about that, but before we get there, let's tell our listeners, we always start a little bit about, give us your, you know, the quick background. Where did Robert Overtuff grow up, and why'd you end up in the Navy, and give us a little bit of that thumbnail.
I was born and raised in Bowling Green, Kentucky. I think I ended up in the Navy pretty much for a lot of the same reasons that many of us joined the military. I did not know what to do with my life. And I can pinpoint the exact moment when I made that decision. I was a junior in high school. I had my head down in class, second period algebra class. I was miserable. I was failing algebra. I didn't even know if I was going to be able to graduate high school because my grades were so bad. And I was just thinking about what was I going to do with my life. I was panicking. I was miserable. And I just had this epiphany of I hung out with mostly older kids, and I had seen them graduate, and I was thinking about what they were doing, and they weren't doing anything. They were doing the exact same things. They weren't doing any, I didn't want to be like them. I wanted something greater. And I just had this epiphany of, I'm going to join the military. I want to get out of town. I want to go places. I want to do things. So after I got out of school, I went to go talk to the recruiters. And
well, it worked out okay. You spent 28 years in the Navy, first as an enlisted man, and then got commissioned, retiring as a lieutenant commander. I have to laugh, though, because you got in because you hated school and math, algebra class. Man, that was the lightning bolt. And the Navy, in their wisdom, what'd they send you off to do?
Well, you know, I originally joined, I wanted to be a rescue swimmer. Top Gun, I realized, unfortunately, they weren't going to let me fly F-14s right out of high school. That was a severe disappointment that I couldn't be Tom Cruise. So I wanted to be that guy that jumped out of helicopters, but my sinuses didn't let me into rescue swimmer school. So they sent me to electronic technician school because that sounded really, really cool. But what I didn't realize, it was full of math. And I had to learn math, and that was absolutely terrifying. And fear is a great motivator, absolutely great motivator. And I learned how to study.
Well, I think a lot of us have had that story, and we've told it many times in Veterans Radio, so our listeners should certainly pass it along to their friends and their family member. As I said, it all worked out, Bob. You ended up picking up your Bachelor's of Arts degree from a college in Kentucky, but even more impressive, you picked up your Master's of Arts degree from the Naval War College, which is quite impressive. So you had a long and interesting career, but let me turn you to the USS Cole. Tell us a little bit about that ship before that fateful day on October 12, 2000. Tell us about the crew a little bit, and then we'll move into those other issues.
I checked aboard the Cole in December of 1999. and they were doing workups for deployment when I checked the board. So the summer before, it was very hectic, very busy. We had a lot of underway time, and the crew was very tight. It was a very hectic schedule with exercises and training missions that we had to do. It was an exhausting pace with the operational exercises and that we had to accomplish, getting prepared for deployment. And, it was a very impressive crew from the moment I stepped aboard. And as a brand new ensign, having crossed over from the enlisted ranks, it was a very steep learning curve. Having been enlisted for 12 years before, for anybody who has made that transition, you think you know, you think you got it, but once you do it, you don't got it. And it's very difficult. So it was a little bit rougher than I expected at first. Those first few months were rougher than I expected, for me to be wearing the gold those first few months and to realize what it was like to be an officer aboard a ship for the first time. Because you realize that your words carry a little bit more weight than what you're used to. Things are a little bit different. You carrying a little bit more responsibility as a division officer. Your responsibilities are substantially more than what you're used to as a E5 or an E6, having crossed over from that point. So it was a lot more hectic, and the responsibilities were a lot greater than what I was used to at that point. And it was a substantially much bigger challenge than what I had been expecting. But at the same time, it was just a phenomenal transition, and it was a great honor to be aboard that ship with that crew. And you know, being that first 8 months, you know, being at sea with Commander Lippold and some of the things we had done down in the South Atlantic and in the Gulf of Mexico, it was really a fantastic time. During some of the exercises we had done, it was a fantastic time working up to the pre-deployment.
And talk to us a little bit about the deployment and what the mission of the COLE was in the fall of 2000.
Well, when we deployed with the strike group, and when we crossed the Atlantic, it was going to be a little bit different than previous missions. When we crossed the Atlantic, we were splitting off from the strike group, and we were going to hold off from the strike group, and we were going to hit Liberty ports early and then relieve one of the other destroyers that were going to go on station in the Gulf early and then come in late and relieve them and then stand on station later. Does that make sense?
It does. And as a new ensign on the COLE, what was your set of duties and responsibilities?
I was the dispersing officer. I was a supply corps officer. When I chose to take my commission, I still had that desire to fly. I still wanted to be a pilot. I still wanted to do something cool and high speed. But my officer recruiters, who were pilots, talked me out of it. And they said, look, you know, being a pilot is not like it is in the movies. You want to do something that's going to be stable and provide a steady income when you eventually grow up and have a family to support. You should be a supply corps officer, because that's the adult thing to do. And it's actually going to be the coolest job on the ship and be a good job for when you get out and retire one day. So I chose to be a supply corps officer. So your first job going at sea is the dispersing officer. And that's what I was aboard COLE. I was the dispersing officer. And
for our listeners who've never been on ship, and I held a lot of those titles. The one I hearken back to most was being in charge of R&R and being the movie officer, which is very important on the ship. Back in the days before everything was digital, but really a ship is like a little city. You got to do everything on it, don't you?
Yes, you do. My primary duty as dispersing officer is I did run the pay office that handled pay and personal matters. I also ran the ship store. You've got like a little 7-Eleven at the inside the ship that that sells candy and sodas, but all your toiletry items. We ran barbershops. We ran a ship's laundry. I also helped assist the main supply officer with the ship's galley and then the parts operation. But I had collateral duties as well. I was a helicopter control officer. I was also a damage control officer, damage locker control officer. And I ran one of the repair locker officers in the back. Aboard a destroyer, you've got three damage control officer lockers. And those are like small closets that have all your damage repair gear in case of a major casualty like fire, flooding, a major contingency. And, you know, think of them as like mini tiny fire stations. So on board a destroyer, you've got one up front, one in the middle, and one in the back. And I'm using civilian terms here so the Army guys can get it.
Exactly. That's why I'm having you explain this, because the Army guys are lost. They have no idea what the dispersing officer is. So
that was one of my collateral duties, as long as being a helicopter control officer. So when I was one of the guys, whenever a helicopter would come in, I would go back to the Hilo control tower and talk to the Hilo and guide them in and land them, like an air traffic control officer.
So let me ask you another sort of structural question that those not familiar with Navy ships might go, I'm having a hard time visualizing this. So how many decks are there from the on the coal? And this is going to be relevant, obviously, when we start talking about where the explosion was.
How many decks are on board a destroyer? Now you're asking me a structural question that I cannot remember.
I'm sorry.
If I answer this and get this wrong, my Navy guys are going to roast me.
They are. So we'll just leave it that there are multiple. I think it's important for people to realize as we get into this next discussion is...
Let me answer this. An Arleigh Burke-class destroyer is 505 feet long, 106 feet wide of American fighting steel. How about that?
See, that's drilled in, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
So let's go ahead and turn to October 12th, 2000. It's late morning. Where are you, and walk us through what happens that day when the Al-Qaeda attack occurs?
Okay. Well, let me back up a little bit and say that during our transit across the Atlantic and kind of tooling around in the Mediterranean for the first couple of months, kind of waiting until we inch up into the 6th Fleet, we had run multiple casualty drills, just for preparedness. So as being a repair locker officer, you know, I was getting more and more and more training on casualty drills and repair drills for fire, flooding, and everything else. So on the morning of October 12th, we had come down, we had transited through the Red Sea, and I had been awake for well over 30 hours because I also stood bridge watch. And that's, you know, where you stand on the bridge and drive the ship as part of the watch team. So I had been on the bridge for the transit through the Suez Canal as part of the bridge team through the Suez Canal, and then partly through the transit down to the Red Sea. And then I stood on sea and anchor detail as we waited to pull in to the port of Aden, Yemen, and finally get moored to the fuel dolphin. And there was a little bit of a delay there. So by the time we actually got tied up, I had been awake for probably close to 40-something hours, well over 30, maybe 40-something hours, I forget. And I was exhausted. I was loopy. And by the time we secured from scene anchor detail, it was just about lunchtime. And I came down to the mess decks to see, even though they weren't serving lunch yet, I had asked our mess specialist, our cooks, if there was any way I could get some food early. And they're like, no, it's not ready yet. It's not ready yet. And our first class mess specialist, our cook, said, look, I'll save you a plate. Just go get a nap. I said, thanks. You know, I appreciate it. I'm exhausted. So I was standing in the passageway. There's a T. It makes a T where the main deck is, and then it goes across the ship where this T is. And I was standing with my back at this T. And we just kind of stood there and talked with my ship serviceman first class, who had just made chief, and then my mess specialist first class. They now call them, well, they used to be cooks. They used to be mess specialists first class. They now call them culinary specialists. I was standing there talking to both of them when they both convinced me to just go take a nap because they could see that I was really just beyond tired. I turned and I walked back aft towards my stateroom, which was about 70 feet aft. I walked into my stateroom, took off my coveralls, and climbed up into my rack. And as I was climbing into my rack is when the bomb hit. And where the bomb hit was exactly where I'd been standing.
And this is obviously something that's unexpected, but for
yes.
which all sorts of drilling and preparing has been going on. What happens?
Yes.
What happens next?
Well, you know, usually when we prepare, we always prepare like we know that we're in some sort of a confrontation. Like we know missiles are coming in and we brace for shock. We brace for impact. We know, you know, like there's a torpedo coming in or something like that. This was completely unexpected. Out of the blue, we're calm. We just tied up. People are relaxing. We're getting ready to go to lunch. We were just beginning to take on fuel. So when this hit, boom, you know, when I hit the deck, my first thought was we just had a fuel explosion. Something went wrong with the fuel transfer. So as I'm scrambling to put my coveralls back on and put my boots back on, that's the only thing that can go through my mind is we just had a major fuel explosion. This has got to be bad, you know, because that's the only thing that makes any sense. But if anybody knows what I'm talking about that's ever been through a major accident or something like this, your brain starts to multitask and you start processing different threads at the same time. So the one thought that I'm focused on is that we've had a major fuel explosion, but at the same time, my brain starts splitting off into different threads and processing the fact that no, the ship moved in the opposite direction. That doesn't make any sense. We were taking fuel on the starboard side. The ship moved from the port side. The ship went down from the port. That doesn't make any sense. That's not making any sense. Why did the ship go down? Why did the ship go up? The kinetics of it didn't make any sense. You know, it's in that split second when time slows down, but your brain speeds up. So when I got my coveralls and my boots on and I opened my stateroom door, the smell answered all my questions. Because there's that distinct smell that any of us who have ever been in combat or been around any explosions or firearms or been to the firing range, we know that smell. We know what that smell is. And it was, oh crap, we've been hit. Oh my God, we've been hit. That's not a fuel explosion. So I ran down to my repair locker and opened my repair locker. And by the time I got to my repair locker, we were listing to the side pretty heavily and we were taking on water.
Now this is a big hole, listeners, that's opened up in the ship. It's reported to be 40 foot by 60 foot gash on the port side, right about at the water line. At the time, you don't know what's going on. talk to us about the noise, the communication, the other men. Bob, what's the, again, this has got to be an ensign's worst nightmare.
Yeah, and let me hit pause for just 1 second, and let me clear up something. That one of the misperceptions that has been perpetuated by the media over the years, there is no way of knowing. A lot of the misperception that's been perpetuated by the media over the years is how this attack occurred. When a Navy ship pulls into port, there's always logistic requirements that are required, you know, to support the ship. And we knew we had communicated there was going to be small line handling boats to assist us with tying up to the small fuel pier. This small fuel pier was several dozen yards, almost 100 yards offshore to facilitate the refueling. This was way out in the harbor of Aden, Yemen. We knew that these small boats were going to be approaching. They were allowed to approach. There was no other small boats around. There was absolutely nothing else around. We knew these were accepted by us. These were known to us, and there was no other perceived threats to us. And some of the imagery and myths that have been perpetuated by the media are absolutely false. There was nothing to indicate a threat prior to. So the bombers had been working with insiders knowing that we were going to be requesting small boats for assistance. So that's how that came about.
And indeed, let me just put an even finer point on it. This incident was heavily investigated by the government, our government, all sorts of different agencies, and the captain of the ship, Commander Kirk Leopold, was cleared of any wrongdoing and actually recognized for his heroic actions to save lives during this incident.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I can tell you, if it had not been for his proactive actions and, you know, pulling into that port, there's a thing about gut instinct. And when we pulled in, everybody had a bad feeling. Everybody had a bad feeling. He had a bad feeling. And we have a material condition on ship. And he had a bad feeling. He put us at the material condition that you set at when you go into battle. And he just said, you know what, let's go ahead and set condition whatever, you know, just in case. And he put us at that increased material condition and security condition because he had that instinct. And it was his increased training. It was his instincts that saved a lot of lives and saved the ship. That ship is in service today because of him, and a lot of lives were saved because of him.
Before we run out of time, Bob, I told you this would go faster than you thought. We ought to mention that 17 sailors lost their lives in this attack, and they range from the ages of 19 to 35, mostly enlisted, but there was another ensign who lost his life that day as well. And it's reported that 39 others were wounded in that initial explosion. But I suspect many, many more have suffered residual injuries as a result of that explosion. And we just should not go by. And I know you want to talk about the sailors who were lost and injured that day.
Well, yes. Real quick, let me just say, going back to the moment where we stopped, where I went back and opened my repair locker, and you asked about communications. Communications were cut off. The ship was silent. It was absolutely silent. And it was the training of the crew, and it was the superb actions and the professionalism of the crew. It was unbelievable how the crew members jumped into action with no communications that we had been training on, but they jumped into action and saved the ship and working on their own and forming teams on their own, completely on their own accord, forming teams completely out of how we had been training, but being able to do it on their own to be able to save the ship. And just unbelievable acts of heroism that went on. There are 300 individual stories of heroism that happened that day and those following days that we were on board to save that ship. Just unbelievable that someday I wish the entire story could get told from 300 something different perspectives of what went on. Now, yes, there were a lot of injuries. There are a lot of injuries that persist today. There's a lot of battles that go on today, but there's a lot of stories of success. I'm not the only one that went blue to gold, meeting Mustang, enlisted the officers. There's quite a few that went on to go cross over to officer after the Cole event. I can think of two right off the top of my head. One just retired this last week. He was a first class in E6 on board the Cole that was critically injured in the blast. And he just retired as a lieutenant commander this last week, a Purple Heart winner, awarding earner. And
I think it's important and to tell these stories, Bob. That's what we try to do here on Veterans Radio. As we run out of time, we've just touched the surface on this. I'd encourage those who are interested to do more research, do some more reading on this, understand what the men and women of the Navy go through. We don't hear enough of these stories, and many of us just aren't familiar with what life on ship's about. It's been a pleasure to have Lieutenant Commander Bob Overtuff, retired, participate here on Veterans Radio today and give us a little history lesson and remind us that as we come up to October, we should be thinking about what happened in October of 2000 on the USS Cole. And I want to thank everybody for listening to Veterans Radio today. I am Jim Fossone. It's been a pleasure to be your host. I'm a veterans disability lawyer at Legal Help for Veterans, and you can reach us at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com on the web. You can follow Veterans Radio on Facebook and listen to its podcasts and internet radio shows by going to veteransradio.net. And until next time, you are dismissed.
If you have a VA claim denied by the Board of Veterans Appeals, contact Legal Help for Veterans at 1-800-693-4800. They're experts in handling cases before the U.S. Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims. Their number again, 1-800-693-4800.